This is the alternative media, exposing government corruption, defending our suspended constitution, demanding the rights of we the people, broadcasting the truth. The puppet media dare not report. Long live liberty and death to the new world order. Prepare yourself. This is the alternative media.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio. And today I have as my very special guest, Professor Kevin McDonald. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Patrick.
Thank you for coming. You're well known for your trilogy of books about Jewish history and Jewish power. But today I want to talk about what seems to be your new interest, which is in the origins of the European people. There's a tendency to think about, among some people at least, humanity as having this three-part racial structure, Europeans, East Asians, and Africans, which is certainly a good framework for looking at race today. Doesn't include everything. But if we're looking at origins, we're looking back 3,000 years, 10,000 years, 50,000 years, it's not necessarily going to be that same structure. So I know you've looked a lot into European origins, and while we like to think of our ancestors as having been in Europe for 50,000 years or more, and there's certainly an element of our ancestors who have been there that long, there are a lot of new findings that are coming out, and by no means is the story set in stone. There's a lot of things that are coming out due to genetics, and you've been doing a lot of research into the population genetics. And a lot of this has been made possible by new technology, the ability to decode the genome, and then developments by, in particular, Svante Paabo, who pioneered techniques for teasing genetic material out of ancient bones, ancient remains, even out of Neanderthals. And the developments have been so fast that this field, in terms of how much information can be derived from ancient material, has exploded faster than the silicon chip. I mean, we know that every 18 months or so, the silicon chip is going up by orders of magnitude, the amount of information. The explosion in information about our genetics is much faster than that even. So, and we're in the midst of it. So here we are at the middle of this revolution. We don't exactly know how everything's going to end, but we want to talk about some of the developments, and then later I want to get into what are going to be the various political spins on these developments. So you talk about the origins of the modern Europeans, and there's three main ancestral populations. Would you like to go into that?
Yes, I'd first like to reiterate what you say about how complex this issue is and how things are constantly changing. I mean, this is something that is really intensely researched right now. There are a lot of laboratories now that are doing this. But I think there's pretty much agreement right now on the broad outlines. I'd say that there are three ancestral groups of Europeans. One is the so-called primordial hunter-gatherers, especially in the north of Europe, probably as soon as the ice ages ended. So you're talking 40,000 years ago that they started, you know, coming back and resettling Europe. Then you've got what they call the early farmers from the Levant that crossed over from Turkey, maybe 5,000 BC, I guess. And then the Indo-Europeans spreading out from the Caucasus area in what's modern Ukraine and extending, really. You know, they went down into India, they went over as far as China. This was an extremely successful, totally militarized group, and they are responsible for all of the European languages that we have now.
With a few small exceptions.
Yeah, it's a very successful group. So I think there's a broad agreement on those three groups and a general time frame, but then exactly how much admixture, exactly what these people look like, I see that as being less of a consensus and less replicated. But that is what I see as the outlines of it. Mm-hmm.
David Reich from Harvard and Johannes Krauss, who he's a German. I'm not sure what institution he's affiliated with currently. They've done a lot of work on this and have both produced these tables of the various ethnic groups in Europe. And you could look at most of the groups in Southern Europe seem to have a lot of the early farmer ancestry, a certain amount of Indo-European, and then the least amount of primordial hunter-gatherers. In fact, the island of Sardinia in the Mediterranean seems to be almost exclusively early farmers. And as you go north in Europe, this mix changes. So if you're going into Scandinavia or the Baltic areas like Lithuania, Estonia, you're going to see the highest amounts of these primordial hunter-gatherers. So there's somewhat different mixes, but basically these three stocks. And at least according to David Reich from Harvard, these groups were genetically almost as different from each other as a Frenchman is from a Chinaman. So you could look at them as being different races. And, of course, this isn't something unique to Europe. If you look at the Indian subcontinent, you had a race that is usually called ancestral southern Indian population, but more colloquially, the Dravidians. And you have these same Indo-Europeans who came into Europe had also gone into India. And there's a great deal of admixture there, although it's uneven. It's more Indo-European in the north and more Dravidian in the south. Probably in other areas, you'll find the same thing. So perhaps if you went back 10,000 years and wanted a framework for the racial structure of humanity, instead of having these three main races and maybe a few tiny and disappearing races like Bushmen and Aborigines, maybe you'd have a dozen races that were distinct from each other. This is the type of thing that's coming out, and certainly nothing set in stone. You mentioned the primordial hunter-gatherers who may very well have been in Europe, well, certainly during the Ice Ages. We could be talking 40,000 years. We could be talking even longer. And there's some research that's come out looking at genes of certain skeletons. You're talking about a small number of skeletons, but each one that was sampled was showing a gene for blue eyes, but also a gene for dark skin, at least in these particular skeletons. And we don't see the dark skin gene anymore. In fact, you don't see any population on Earth that has the mixture of dark skin and blue eyes. And these primordial hunter-gatherers, they live on in admixed form in most Europeans, although nowhere are they more than 50% of our genetic heritage. So in a way, while they have descendants who are alive today, hundreds of millions of descendants, as a race, they don't exist anymore. I invite you to look at that in any way you want, but I bring it up partly because you have this meme out there now, and I'll use the term meme, that there's no such thing as race, or that it doesn't matter that the races come together. There's something that's gone on throughout history. Well, in a way, it has gone on throughout history, but you can look at all these examples and see where it was very disadvantageous to one race or another. You can look and see that in some instances when the races come together, the males of one group lose access to females, and the Y chromosomes pretty much drop out of the picture. So when you think about these dark-skinned, blue-eyed people who seem to be among our ancestors, what does that make you think of? What do you think of their historical experience?
Well, I think that in the north of Europe, you had these Western hunter-gatherers, and I think in the north of Europe, there was selection for white skin and blue eyes within that population. So they became that, and at least I just wrote a paper summarizing some of this, focusing on the Indo-Europeans, but you have to talk about the other. Well, and at least by 8,000 before present, that would be like 6,000 BC. Some of the samples already show this is before the Indo-Europeans came. Mm-hmm. In Scandinavia, you have white skin and blue eyes. So what I'm suggesting is that this group may well have started out, if you look at it 45,000 years ago, they may have had dark skin. They may even have had dark eyes, but you had selection for one reason or another mm-hmm. within that population so that people with lighter skin and bluer eyes did better. Mm-hmm. Maybe they absorbed vitamin D better. Maybe that they were more seen as more sexually attractive. And so you had selection within that group. So in Scandinavia now, you have the highest percentage, I suppose, of blonde-haired, blue-eyed people around. Mm-hmm. I think the Indo-Europeans were not as, you know, and this is controversial because I know some people think of the Europeans as blonde-haired and all that. But the studies I've seen, they have brown eyes. But again, when they conquered Europe, when they went into the rest of Europe, you're going to have admixture. The Indo-Europeans did not put up barriers. They eventually intermarried with other people. And as you say, quite often it was to the advantage of the males of that group, which is something we should always remember. The admixture carries costs from one population to the other, usually. When Indo-Europeans went in, they weren't nice guys. They were a military conquering group. And the people that they overwhelmed, they enslaved, typically. They dominated. But within those groups, one of my findings is, in general, within the Indo-European groups, there's upward mobility possible. So that, say, your ancestors were all Scandinavian hunter-gatherers, these northern hunter-gatherers, and you may well have been dominated by the Indo-Europeans, but if you were a warrior, if you were able to show these military virtues, you could rise. And so there was selection for that within these northern European groups. And so today we still see overwhelmingly light hair, light skin, blue eyes, and that kind of thing. So I think selection does occur. We can't think of these groups as static. And so I think that over time, there was a selection for blonder hair, bluer eyes, lighter skin in the north. And it could be for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, as I mentioned, sexual selection is a very powerful thing. Mm-hmm. And so if those traits are valued in a marriage partner, well, then the wealthier, more powerful people are going to marry females with those traits, have children with them more often, and they are going to gradually have selection for those traits, just like any other trait.
Right.
You think about intelligence. Intelligence was also, I think, very highly adaptive, especially in the north compared to Africa, say. And so over time, you've had selection for intelligence. People who are less intelligent just didn't do as well. They didn't plan as well. They didn't take advantage of opportunities as well. And so those genes gradually lost out.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that selection is taking place, this is huge, because part of the there's no such thing as race mythology is based on this notion that somehow evolution in humans just stopped 50,000 years ago. It just stopped. And it's funny because you have people on the so-called left. I tend to avoid the left-right paradigm because I think that so much of the left paradigm is really a Jewish paradigm. But at any rate, they make fun of conservatives, especially conservative Christians who question evolution. And yet this most basic tenet of evolution, they're saying, well, somehow humans were exempt from it, that evolution stopped. So you did have a huge number of traits that are under selection. And with this new research and the new techniques that have been developed by Svante Paabo that made all of this possible, you can look at genomes even of isolated populations where you're not having admixture and you're still seeing differences over time that traits were selected for. Now, with regard to the blue eyes and the light skin, one question is the default population that came out of Africa would have had dark eyes and dark skin.
Right.
And so where did the mutation take place? So with blue eyes, it seems almost certain that the mutation took place in Northern Europe or in Europe during the Ice Age for whatever reason, whether it was sexual selection because they were attractive or because there's some sort of survival advantage to it, it became predominant. With the light skin, it seems to have happened later. And so it was the mutation that led to the light skin or the mutations, because it's probably something that's on several genes. Did that take place in Northern Europe? Or was that something that maybe this Ice Age population that was covering its skin anyway and that was eating meat and eating shellfish and things like that and getting its vitamin D through its diet and not needing to produce it in the skin, maybe it wasn't such a disadvantage for them. But when agriculture took place, perhaps the genes for white skin came in through these farmers, and it would have been more important for farmers who aren't getting vitamin D through the diet. This is something that is still a matter of speculation. We won't know.
My impression is that the early farmers, so-called, did have white skin, but probably not blue eyes.
No. You don't see blue eyes really anywhere else in the world where you haven't had Europeans.
Yeah, I mean, right? It's unique.
And you mentioned the differential access to women. Places where you've had admixtures, you can look at this with the Indian population, because everybody in India is mixed, just at different ratios. But everywhere in India, you do see this bias with their Y chromosomes, which come from the fathers.
Right.
The Y chromosomes are, no matter where you go, are primarily Indo-European. The mitochondrial DNA, which comes from mothers, is more likely to be Southern European. And if you look in more historical times, you see that with the Black American population, that the tendency to have Y chromosomes from Europe, but mitochondrial from Africa, and the mestizo populations of Latin America, it's just huge that the mestizo population almost exclusively have European Y chromosomes. In other words, when you look at these mestizos, you're looking at a race that doesn't have any male input from the Indians. The Indians completely lost access to females. Have you looked much at, say, marriage statistics in Europe or other places where there's a great deal of immigration nowadays? Is this something we're finding nowadays, this differential access to women?
Well, I don't know. I hope that Europeans are not simply interbreeding with these foreigners that are coming in. We do see some of that, certainly. I think that sometimes these immigrants seem more masculine, you know, and they're more aggressive. And European males now are, so many of them are so effeminized, and so they probably don't seem as attractive as they used to be. So I don't know. My experience just looking around the United States is that the quality of women interbreeding with blacks is not high. Mm-hmm. They tend to be on the lower end of physical attractiveness and socioeconomics and intelligence and so on. They're coming at a sort of underclass of people that do that. But I don't think it's that common for really high-quality women
although
doing that, except for movie stars.
And with movie stars doing it, doesn't that set an example?
Yeah. It's a pretty small percentage, I'd say, the movie stars, celebrities that are able to do that. O.J. Simpson, his white wife. And you do see that, certainly. And that's the thing about women, that if you look at Phil Rushton's work on genetic similarity, there's an attraction between people who are similar. And overall, people who marry each other are more similar than average. But there are things that can overcome that. And one is simply high social status, wealth, and so on. That seems to check that so that you might have a white woman who, even though she's not at all genetically similar to a black guy, she might be attracted because he's a star, he's got piles of money, something like that. So that does happen.
So we hear through the Jewish-dominated academia and media that race doesn't exist. And you've done all sorts of work that you don't have to recap here necessarily, going back to Franz Boas and 100 years ago, this Jewish-led movement in academia towards dismissing race as a biological phenomenon, just dismissing it. And you hear all sorts of arguments out there. One that I heard from Sarah Tishkoff, who's a Jewish geneticist at the University of Pennsylvania, who does good work and should really know better. She researches Africans. But she'll repeat this saying that, well, because there's more genetic diversity within groups, there's more genetic differences within groups than between groups, it shows that race isn't a useful idea. And of course, that was never the issue with race. And you could say the exact same things about breeds of dogs.
That's called Lewinton's fallacy. Just because variation is higher within groups and between groups doesn't mean that the between group thing doesn't exist or that it's not important. And that's the thing. It may be 15%. But that doesn't mean it's not important. Frank Salter's gone through that, his book on genetic interest. It's a foolish argument, but it's been around, and Richard Lewinton is a prime example. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure this other woman you're talking about, they very self-consciously use their position in the academic world to advance a political agenda. He actually said that. He was very motivated to get to Harvard and, you know, have this big reputation, where he did very good, solid population genetic work when he was younger. And then to be able to use that capital to be able to advance his political views, which were thoroughly Marxist. So that's what they do. And yeah, there's an element of dishonesty to it, for sure. But if you're the media, the New York Times, you either don't know any better, or you're very happy to find someone like that who's got an economic position and is willing to say things that you want to hear because you are writing for a left-wing publication that desperately wants to convince white people that there's no such thing as race. The simple idea that races are biological descent groups, that we do have common ancestors, that there are genetic differences between the races and so on, that is indisputable at this point. You can't dispute it. Yet that is used constantly. Or they'll make an argument that if there's any admixture at all from anywhere, well, there's some mestizos. So they set up these false arguments, straw men arguments, where you've got to have absolutely genetically pure races and there can't be any admixture. But of course, there's always some.
Of course.
What Vince Sarich called fuzzy boundaries, fuzzy sets. They're not absolute, hard, and fast, but they're fuzzy, but they're real. and they set off a real group of people.
Right. And regarding this notion of having more genetic difference within groups than between groups, it doesn't matter that there's more or less, but one thing is that within groups, a lot of this genetic difference and diversity are genes that really don't express themselves or genes that aren't under selection. The traits that vary between groups are traits that are under selection that gave the individual who has the trait an evolutionary advantage, whether it's, you know, being able to produce vitamin D better in a northern climate or having a sickle cell recessive gene that allows you to combat malaria or lactose tolerance. These are genes that are under selection, and you just can't throw them in there with differences that have no expression in our phenotype.
Yeah, some of these genes may have been just the result of drift between populations. But yeah, some of them are definitely under selection. You think about IQ. You know, there's a well-known north-south gradient in IQ all around the world. And when you look at Phil Rush's data, Jensen, and so on, they have argued very persuasively that this is a genetic difference. Well, it could be that there's only 15% difference between Africans and Europeans. But that 15% is coding, apparently, for IQ. And that's a huge difference if your average IQ is 70 or 100. And it's just a massive difference in being able to confront the modern world, solve problems, and so on. So it's silly to make this argument. But the entire issue of race has become thoroughly politicized. It can't be discussed in a rational, scientific way. It always amuses me to see these leftists come claiming that conservatives don't want to deal with science, like climate science and all that. Well, try to get a leftist to deal with race honestly, right, with IQ honestly, even without talking about genetics. Just simply talk about trying to change IQ. They can't do it, because they want to ascribe any difference between blacks and whites, Africans and Europeans, as due to some kind of racism by white people. And that's the end of the story. And they want to claim that that is scientific. So that's just part of the game. I recall there was a thing just recently that this group of sexual nonconformists, you know, LGBT, and then they had like four or five more letters. I don't even know what they mean.
They don't even know what they mean. Q. Yeah, what does Q mean?
They set up a society dedicated to the science of gender. They don't care about science. They have an ideology. Any science that came up with conclusions that disagreed with their idea that it's all a cultural construct, that anybody can be any sexual identity they want.
There's a gender continuum.
Genetics makes no difference. Anything that disagrees with that, they're just going to throw out as racist or sexist or some damn thing. So this is where we're at now, because the domination of the left and the universities, we constantly see political axe grinding in that area.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had some years ago a skeleton that was found in, I believe, Washington State in Kennewick. Yeah, the Kennewick man. And morphologically, it had a lot of European features. When there was finally a genetic study done on it, it didn't seem so European. But be that as it may, one thing it did was it sparked off this giant debate and struggle, really, about who has the right to North America. And the Indian tribe that is native to that area wanted that skeleton back and got the skeleton back. They weren't able to destroy it, but they wanted it back for reburial. I don't know if they got it back, but they were able to at least deprive it from the scientists for a number of years. And then you hear other people talking about, well, this proves that European Solutrians were here first, and that gives whites the right to the continent. I'm not here to settle that debate, but this is the type of thing that gets talked about. And that being as it may, At the beginning of the show, you were talking about these three ancestral groups that wound up more or less merging into modern Europeans. The primordial hunter-gatherers who had been in Europe the longest, these early farmers who might have come 5,000 years ago, and the Indo-Europeans who came even more recently. And so somebody could come out and say, well, look, the European race, as it's currently constructed, the Europeans are only 3,000 years old. So what does it matter if now we have the next chapters having Africans and Middle Easterners have their go at Europe? What would you say to those people?
Well, again, I think you said it before, that this would entail a genetic cost to the current European population, that there would be selection against European genes, selection in favor of African genes, Middle Eastern genes, and so on. There'd be natural selection. And, you know, ultimately, given the fertility of these groups and so on, if you would project 1,000 years into the future, you'd see very few European genes anymore. It would just be taken over. Yeah, you know, really a case of evolutionary extinction. So I think that's one thing that, as an evolutionist, and it's amazing, is that I'm a professional and I used to belong to all these societies and everything. People who are professional evolutionists do not take natural selection in human populations seriously. The typical evolutionary people, like people in the Human Behavior and Evolution Society, they tend to be on the left like everybody else, and they want immigration, they want all this stuff going on. In other words, if they looked at an animal population and you had a species that was a subspecies or something like that, you know, this neighboring group where you have chimpanzees and they come in and they kill the males and they kill the cubs and they mate with the females and that sort of thing, you know, you can see natural selection in action there. And they would talk about that. And they would talk about genetic effects. But when it comes to humans, they throw all that out. And they become just as woolly-headed as any leftist and ignore it. And just an amazing phenomenon of sort of groupthink and wanting to be a part of this leftist zeitgeist. It's an amazing phenomenon. You have to almost be there to experience, I think you have, where you just see how these people think. And they're on page. Their main issue is to be seen as a moral person, I think. They want to be seen as a good guy. And they dread being called a racist. They dread being called a bad person. They dread being seen as someone who opposes or compromises anyone else's interests, but they don't care about the interests of their people or their genetic ancestry, which is a fundamental rule of evolution. So it just amazes me to see that. And I see it over and over and over again.
And there's, among people who should know better, this desire not to be called racist, this desire to be considered moral. That's a big factor. Among, let's just say, students, people coming up, graduate students even, people who don't necessarily know better. This is the prevailing narrative. This is the default knowledge. In order to overcome it, they have to a large extent, either be exposed to arguments and information that are suppressed or reinvent the wheel themselves.
Yeah.
So it's not easy.
It's very sad when you see recent graduate students come in, PhDs, and they get a job. It's almost like their eyes are glazed over.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
You, your husband, your wife, your children, we all need food. And with dozens of food storage companies buying up airtime all over radio, it's hard for you to know which company you can actually trust. Hey folks, John Stettmiller here. We at RBN understand, which is why I personally searched out a storable food company and one with similar core values to us here at RBN and of course you, the listener. Well, I found such a company. I'd like to introduce you to Numana Food Storage. Numana Food Storage, highly nutritious, GMO-free, contains no aspartame, no high fructose corn syrup, has no chemical preservatives or soy, and Numana Food Storage has a 25-year shelf life. To back up my claims, we've made Numana Food Storage the exclusive food sponsor of RBN. Call 888-597-0775, 888-597-0775. Order online at NumanaRepublic.com. That's NumanaRepublic.com. Food storage you'll love to eat. You, your husband, your wife, your children, we all need food. And with dozens of food storage companies buying up airtime all over radio, it's hard for you to know which company you can actually trust. Hey folks, John Stettmiller here. We at RBN understand, which is why I personally searched out a storable food company and one with similar core values to us here at RBN and, of course, you, the listener. Well, I found such a company. I'd like to introduce you to Numana Food Storage. Numana Food Storage, highly nutritious, GMO-free, contains no aspartame, no high fructose corn syrup, has no chemical preservatives or soy, and Numana Food Storage has a 25-year shelf life. To back up my claims, we've made Numana Food Storage the exclusive food sponsor of RBN. Call 888-597-0775, 888-597-0775. Order online at NumanaRepublic.com. That's NumanaRepublic.com. Food storage you'll love to eat.
Are you still looking for that one iodine that you can really trust? A medical doctor-endorsed product that is backed by honest research and true integrative science? Then search no further. Go to NutraMedical.com for Dr. Bill Deagle's Nutriodine, proven time and time again to be the very best iodine available for you. Nutriodine is the only Tesla-activated monatomic plasma iodine in the world. It optimizes mitochondrial function and generation of new mitochondria from totally neutralizing the venom from a desert recluse spider bite in Southern California to eliminating malaria parasites reported by medical missionaries in Central India. Dr. Bill's Nutriodine is simply the most powerful healing formula there is. Nutriodine clears the body of all known pathogens, restores it to an alkaline state, and even promotes stem cell regeneration. Order Dr. Bill's Nutriodine today at 888-212-8871 or visit us online at NutraMedical.com.
Oh, fall. My favorite time of year. Cooler temperatures and, well, let's be honest, layers. Lots and lots of layers. Look, I get it. We all have that favorite hoodie. Matter of fact, I've got a few favorite hoodies. You should wear yours. Enjoy it. I do. But I stay focused on my health year-round. And for me, I take Nature's Youth RSF from naturesyouth.com. Nature's Youth RSF from naturesyouth.com. I eat right, control my portion sizes, still maintain a commitment to regular fitness, and I get plenty of rest, and I take Nature's Youth RSF. It's okay to cover up your beach body for a few months, but don't just forget about it. Nature's Youth understands exactly what it means to provide top-quality health products, and Nature's Youth customers not only improve their health, they know they're also providing their body with the right nourishment to maintain peak performance levels and fight the aging process. So layer up and get started today with Nature's Youth RSF. NaturesYouth.com. Simple to use, even simpler to order. Go to NaturesYouth.com. That's NaturesYouth.com.
Been brainwashed and they become zombies almost. But if you're in a program, say social psychology or sociology or gender studies, you have never heard a word about genetics except that it's bad or doesn't exist or something. You've never heard that in your entire academic career, so maybe you can't blame these people. But you're right, in order to get there, you have to invent the wheel yourself, you have to do your own research, and then you would have to deal with the fact that you are going to be ostracized, you're going to be called names, you're not going to have any academic position, you're going to be drummed out of academic societies and so on. So that's the reality. Sadly, though, people like these Jewish population geneticists, they are advancing their own interests when they make those claims. And I think they're very self-consciously doing so. I think they want to promote this idea that there's no such thing as race or genetic differences or it doesn't matter, all that. And so they're acting in a very adaptive way. And the thrust of my research eventually was the idea that ideas are the most important factor now in natural selection among humans. Mm-hmm. In the past, it was military accomplishment or something. But now, whether or not you buy into these ideologies, and these ideologies are really weaponized, they're weaponized against us.
So it's kind of a dysgenic ideas even.
Yeah.
Now, you were talking about natural selection, talking about if you had massive immigration into Europe due to differential birth rates, there's going to be natural selection in favor of the newcomers.
Yeah.
And, of course, is it really a natural selection? It's a selection. They're able to maintain their birth rates due to subsidies from the existing population.
Yeah, there's a massive artificiality about it, but in biological terms, if you look at the genetics, you take a random sample of Europeans in 1900, in 1940, in 1980, 2000, you're going to see genetic changes. Because now any random sample of Europeans is going to have to include substantial percentages of people from other parts of the world. And so there's, in that sense, selection against European genes. They no longer 100%. They're going down gradually, and that's going to continue. You take any gene that's a marker gene for Africans, and it's going to be increasing in Europe. And that's the reality.
So what do you say to people who would say, well, look, Europeans, as we know them, have only been in Europe 5,000 years or 3,000 years. They have less right to the land. Is the right of Europe to Europeans or the right of Americans to America, the native born population here, is it really due to how many generations we go back, how many hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of years we go back, or that we're here now?
Well, exactly. That is one of the crucial issues. You think about America. We Europeans, there may have been some Solutrean thing going on here, maybe the Vikings and so on. But reality is, for the vast majority, Europeans came in the last 300 years. And so the question is, do we have any right to this land? Well, we conquered it. Now, look, this has happened throughout human history in all areas. The Bantu expanded out of the middle of Africa, all over Africa.
In relatively recent times.
Yes, in relatively recent times.
Only reaching South Africa about the same time the Europeans did.
Yeah, and so there's no moral superiority there. You think of the Arab expanding out of Saudi Arabia and then going all through North Africa, up into Spain. They got all the way up to the gates of Vienna. They got at least up to Iran. And the point is they spread their genes. Mm-hmm. Whenever they went, they made harems when they conquered the women and so on. But you never see Arabs apologizing for this or any leftists asking them to apologize.
Yeah, and the Mongols, Mongols and the Turks. I mean, Genghis Khan has 50 million descendants.
So we have to just be proud of our ancestors and what they did and accept it and try to hold on to it. I mean, the Han Chinese started out as a much smaller group and they conquered all these other groups around China, dominated them, and in any society like that, the conquering people took women, and they made harems. And so this is something that people have always done. It's only the West that is made to feel guilty for this. And the people trying to make them feel guilty always fail to talk about other groups that have done this throughout history. And so we just have to try to stand up for what we did and see our group as having as much of a claim as anybody to this and stop feeling guilty about things like slavery. White people are the only group that ended slavery, but that's a constant thing, whereas slavery continues to exist in Africa. The Arabs never stopped the slave trading and so on, except for European intervention. So this is just a complete assault on our people, really.
Mm-hmm.
We have to see it as politically, ideologically, ethnically, and genetically motivated by these groups.
And you just said that the Europeans were the only group to ban slavery. Also, at the height of their power, at the height of their expansion, they introduce a new morality whereby expansion is no longer acceptable, and then voluntarily disengage from Africa and much of Asia.
Right.
And today are the only people who no longer have any homeland that is considered theirs and theirs alone.
Exactly. And that's the rub right there. And that's really a big part of my research. The genetics are interesting, but what is it about Europeans that makes these moral arguments and concerns and photos of Syrian children washing up on the beach and talking about what happened in terms of slavery 300 years ago? Why are those moral arguments so effective with Europeans and with no other group? And no other group is made to feel guilty about this. No other group does feel guilty. So I'm trying to understand this moral component of our civilization.
So one of the reasons I wanted to do this, perhaps even the main reason I wanted to have this discussion, was I sometimes hear people say that we have a right to North America because the Solutreans were here first. And I think that's problematic. I hear some people saying this land is our land because we conquered it and we hold it, which is also not necessarily the right thing to say when your people are losing power, right? And the United States, we have basically a Jewish control over us, who's conquering whom. But we're here, and we shouldn't have to apologize for history, because nobody else apologizes for history. We were born into this world.
Exactly. I'm personally comfortable with saying we conquered it, it's our land, and we should try to maintain it. You're right, we are dominated now by a hostile elite, we're made to feel guilty, and we are losing power. We can only hope that the Trump administration will try to turn things around. I think there's an understanding at the top of this administration, Steve Bannon, I think there's an understanding that if they don't change things, white America is gone. And they already see what's happening in Europe. I think they want to really turn back this thing. And we'll see if they can succeed. But it's going to be very difficult, obviously, at this point. But this is what we have to do, I think. We have to reassert ourselves as a people. I don't see us being able to argue about Solutreans in a convincing way.
And if it turns out that this Solutrean hypothesis, that people came from Europe over the Atlantic Ocean and came to North America, if it turns out there's nothing to it, should we feel that we don't have as much right to America?
Yeah, that's the issue. I would say no. My view is that we conquered the Stone Age civilization fair and square, and we should keep it in the same way that the Arabs have never. What's going to happen? Everybody's going to go back to where they started. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, according to the Jews, it seems that God laid out property rights, what, 3,000 years ago? I'm saying that kind of facetiously, obviously.
Yeah, you are, but that's exactly what they say, and they're going to conquer. It's pretty hard to make Jews feel guilty about the settlements and about their control, and you see that a lot of the really hardline ones, they see what God gave Abraham was all the way from the Nile to the Euphrates, which is a lot of territory.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would feel no problem conquering that, and God gave it to them, and that kind of thing. You're not going to be able to get them feel guilty. There's something about Europeans that makes so many of us feel guilty about any kind of transgressions of other people's rights. And I understand that. I try to live my life in a moral way, but the fact is, I don't want to give up North America, Australia, New Zealand, and so on. I don't want to give up those territories our ancestors conquered. And that's simply reality. I don't feel guilty about that.
Right. And you mentioned the Europeans conquered a Stone Age civilization or pre-civilization in America, Australia, of course. And had the Europeans not done this in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, the Chinese or the Arabs sooner or later would have crossed the Atlantic, would have gone to Australia, and would have done the same, probably without reservations, probably without any moral compunction about doing away with the native population altogether.
That's right.
Okay, now looking forward, and I know we're coming up close to the end of the show, but so we're in this situation now. We have had a lot of progress over the past year and a half that was unexpected. We have developments in Europe, massive reaction to the tsunami of immigration, the tsunami-gration, I call it, the Brexit vote, and of course the election of Donald Trump. So there does seem to be an opening. So looking forward, we have a president who at least has said during the campaign that the illegal immigrants have to leave. He's talked about ending birthright citizenship. He's at least indirectly talked about changing the immigration laws, which could mean overturning the 1965 Immigration Act. Now, I know there's a lot of people who, well, people want to turn back the clock. How far you can turn back the clock and how realistically it is, those are different issues. And of course, the situation in the Americas or Australia is not necessarily the same as it is in Europe. But what could we aim for? I mean, there's a certain amount of water under the bridge in terms of race, in terms of eugenics or dysgenics, in terms of evolution. What do you think is realistic that we can aim for?
Well, that's a good question. I would hope that ultimately we can aim for the whole nine yards. But I think first thing we have to do is deport illegals. And I saw an article in the Washington Post that they were floating the idea that immigrants who were here on welfare should be deported. That you shouldn't be importing people and putting them on welfare. Mm-hmm. And the same with refugees, ending the refugee program completely. And then after that, I think it would take a different government, but you have to end birthright citizenship. and we have to be willing to deport people. But we have to incentivize leaving. And I think what it's going to take is the idea that we are explicitly a white country and that we want to remain so. And that's a ways away, obviously. We have to repeal the 1965 immigration law. And those things are a ways off. But I think what could realistically be started here would be deporting illegals, ending refugee policy, except for extreme cases, but not make those citizens, to make them be able to resettle here for a certain period of time until things calm down and then put them back. And then be able to end birthright citizenship. That is something that should be litigated because it's simply not fair. It's ridiculous. And there's no real solid constitutional basis for it. So those things should be done first. And I think it's realistic that those could be done.
And finally, I've heard some people talk about, in order to preserve a European purity, to go off and form some small ethno-state somewhere, to basically abandon America. I don't know how widespread that sentiment is. There are places in Europe where you might wind up with that being more realistic to achieve some sort of Estonian or Latvian purity. But America, with its vast economic and military resources, if you were to have any kind of significant move to separate from America and thus relinquish control over America, to me it would seem suicidal. Because you would be leaving all of those resources that had been, for the most part, built up through the ingenuity and sweat and genius of our ancestors, leaving them under the control of a very hostile population led by a hostile Jewish elite, but with a population that's been largely indoctrinated against Europeans, and especially against Europeans with a European identity. What do you think of that?
I agree. Some people have talked about carving out an ethno-state like in the northwest of the United States, secession. Now we see California, there's a CalExit program where they're going to vote on leaving the Union. I don't think that the United States would allow that. If they did, it might be not a bad precedent that we could look to. But I think it's a bad solution in a lot of ways, as you say. Say you took over Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and eastern Washington, Oregon, or northern California. It's a small space. It's not going to have the kind of economic power and everything that would have had we stayed part of the Union. It's a very bad solution. But if we could really create an ethno-state, it'd be a start. And we do think that ultimately this United States is going to fall apart if it doesn't change direction. I mean, if you keep importing all these millions and millions of low IQ people, how long can this last? There's got to be an upper limit there. So that might be one part of the mix. But basically, we have to try to hold on to this country. I'd much prefer to see a real attempt to roll back all the horrors that we've seen in the last 50 years, to roll it back. And I think in order to do that, ultimately, we have to develop an explicit sense of white identity in majority of white people and understand that we have to do this. And we're a long ways from doing that.
So perhaps roll back where you can roll back, maybe self-segregate where you can self-segregate, and accept a certain amount of water under the bridge, a certain amount of assimilation, especially among those populations that are less undesirable.
If we got an explicitly white majority, we could do a lot of things. We could say, well, Islam is simply not an acceptable religion. And people who came here in the last 50 years that don't really have any roots here, sorry, you got to go back. We can make provisions for them. We can be humane, but we have to make some kind of provision that this is our country.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I am optimistic, as I think all of us are in the alt-right, that the Trump administration is very promising. I'm looking forward to the future. At the same time, you can see that every little thing that he does is going to be greeted with intense hostility. But the good news is, like his recent travel ban to these Muslim countries, does seem to be supported by a solid majority of Americans. So even though you have media outrage and protests in the streets, it doesn't seem to be really affecting the majority of Americans. And I can, it's conceivable that in 4 years that people would really decide that Trump was right about all this stuff, and he'll have a solid majority and a real mandate to really do some serious change.
That's right. I'm glad to hear you're optimistic, because I remember a couple of years ago, you and myself and so many other people didn't have a whole lot of optimism. So
did not. Before Trump got into it, started saying some of the things he was saying, I was absolutely at my wit's end. I said, what am I doing in my life? Because it's like there was nothing that was going in our direction. And we looked ahead and we saw that the Republican candidate is going to be vetted by the wealthy donor class. And it was going to be Jeb Bush or maybe Ted Cruz or, you know, Marco Rubio or something like that. It was just absolutely depressing. You just didn't see any way forward. We were kept out of the media completely. Now we see a way forward, and there's a real possibility here. And we're not sure it's going to work, but, you know, there's a real possibility.
Well, Professor McDonald, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it, and hopefully we can have you back on again sometime.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it.
Or someone you know suffer from chest pain, blood pressure, cholesterol, or irregular heartbeat? Are you looking for a more natural solution to overcome these health challenges? You hear the ads all the time. If this stuff's so good, why doesn't my doctor prescribe it? That's easy. Doctors are not trained in natural medicine. Extendivite Heart Tonic does want you to be as healthy as you can be, and it really works. Take Extendivite for 6 months and your doctor will say, I don't know what you're doing, but don't stop. It's working for you. Get the dependability of Extendivite. Just see how you feel in 6 months. A 2 month supply of either capsules or liquid is only $69.95 plus shipping and handling. Call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with
Roberts & Roberts Brokerage believes that everyone should have some of their assets in investment-grade precious metals. Roberts & Roberts has been a trusted name in precious metals for nearly 40 years. Experienced investors will appreciate our personal service and low prices. If you're new to precious metals, we can help you find the products right for you. Give us a call today at 800-874-9760 or visit us online at rrbi.co. Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, when you're serious about precious metals.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Hi, my name is David Merlin from takefromcaesar.us. Income is defined in the tax code. All property is a cost, including labor, according to statute. You're deprived of the provisions of Section 83 whenever you pay an income tax on your compensation. According to Section 83, only the excess over the amount paid is gross income. The government can't so much as provide an interpretation of Section 83 of its own. Get your paradigm shift and understanding today at takefromcaesar.us.
welcome back to the show. So this is Patrick Slattery, and I understand I think Farron has asked me to fill in for him next week, so I'll try to plan something that'll be fun for us. I hope you all enjoyed the interview with Professor McDonald. That's its world premiere here. A lot of what I'm doing, I'm premiering here on, you'll hear it here first on RBN, on the Alternative Media with Farron Schoaf. So that was a very interesting interview for me, because I've been very interested in the European origins and the all the new genetic information that's coming out. There has been one thing that I'd wanted to somehow insert into that post-production at one point. I'm going to play it for you right here. This was a point I had wanted to make.
Indo-European group seems itself to be an amalgamation of two.
Are you not getting anything? Well, I'm sorry about that. That was a plan. I thought this might work. Maybe I wasn't sticking the mic into the speaker the right way. Well, anyway, so I guess we just have a minute left. But at the end of the interview with Professor McDonald, we talked about how much more optimistic we are now than we had been just 18 months ago. I remember him coming on the David Duke Show a couple of years ago, and he was just despondent. And David said, I don't know if I can have him back. I mean, he's such a great voice for us, but he had become very depressed, and it was hard for any of us to maintain any sense of optimism with all that was going on and the prospect of an election that was going to be between Hillary and Jeb. And then all of a sudden Donald Trump comes along. He's not perfect. Nobody's perfect. But who else could have done this? Who else could have come along and really, just through the force of his own will and his own resources, put himself into that position? Well, there was some help. You know, people like Farron and myself and David Duke and Professor McDonald, we did what we could, but it took somebody with the resources and flamboyance and, you know, the personality power of Donald Trump to do this, get himself into this position. I think he's off to a really good start. I know that he's going to do some things that I don't like, but if he did everything I wanted him to do all at once, who knows what would happen? You know, he'd be assassinated, he'd be impeached. He's got to get some public support. So he's got to have some – he's got to pick and choose his battles, get a few victories, get a lot – he has to get enough public support that he's protected from impeachment. He's got to have strong Secret Service so he's protected from assassination. But if he can – do those things, then the future looks bright. Okay, well, thank you very much, and we will see you next week back here on the Alternative Media with Farron Schoaf and Patrick Slattery.
Plate. Slapping the dust with PatriotPrepared.com carries the leading brands of storable food from Numana, Legacy, and Heaven's Harvest. Patriot Prepared. Our name says it all. We're dedicated to empowering you to be self-reliant and confident in any circumstance. Whether you want to be prepared in the event of an emergency or you're an outdoor sports enthusiast, PatriotPrepared.com has prepackaged meals and kits for your entire family. Legacy, Heaven's Harvest, and Numana are known for high-quality, great-tasting, GMO-free, nutritious food with no chemical preservatives. Simple to prepare, easy to store, gluten-free and organic high-quality nutrition options with a 25-year shelf life. You can't beat the feeling of being food secure when you need it most. So go to PatriotPrepared.com right now to pick up your supply of high-quality storable food for your family, because it makes good sense to be prepared. That's PatriotPrepared.com.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.